I'm Gord Price, and this is Price Talks. I just turned 70 this year, birthday with a zero. Makes me realize what we as human beings do. It's kind of silly, but I guess we need to have labels, and so we take decades and then we apply the zeitgeist to it. We fit history to the narrative, the 60s, the 80s, the millennials. I'm a baby boomer. And then we generalize the hell out of it. And why fight it? So when you do turn a decade, it does sure give you pause to reflect. More than anything, you kind of relabel yourself. And at 70, okay, so I'm stretched to say I'm middle-aged. But more than anything, I'm just more aware of generational passage. That sure, as a retired guy, I'm not in the positions I used to be when I was exercising leadership. And I'm looking more to those who are. And it makes me aware of the need for us as the predecessors to be passing on some of our wisdom that just comes with being older to the successors, generations coming up. Torch passing is what we're going to call this, torch passing. So we looked around for people who've been in roles of leadership, who've helped shape this place, this Vancouver, this little blessed part of the environment that we share, and talk to them about leadership, but more importantly, ask them to choose a successor, someone who they can see is going to, or is in a position of leadership, who is going to be in some ways doing what we did. And so I chose another 70-year-old. Seems right. Hi, Peter Ladner.
Hi, Gord.
How's it feel?
Let's not talk about it.
Oh, come on. You got to talk about it.
When you turn 70, actually, you're not middle-aged, Gordon.
No,
I got to
no.
break this to you.
Yeah.
You're an old guy.
Absolutely.
You're a
geezer. You are old.
Let's just face it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're allowed to sit in those seats in the bus and not feel guilty.
Someone is going to offer you one of them.
That's the worst. No, you should just take them.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, young person.
And when
person.
They say, what are you doing there? You say, I'm 70. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You take all of the perks without blinking. Yeah. You got the orange compass card. Yeah. I got it. But you're not ready to be put out to pasture. You're still in a leadership role. What do you do, Peter?
Well, I tell people I'm pre-tired, like pretend retired. And my wife says I work as much as I ever did. I just don't get paid regularly for it or anything for it. But my main two things I'm doing right now, I'm serving on two boards. I'm the past chair of the David Suzuki Foundation board, and I'm the chair of the Better Transit and Transportation Coalition. And I chirp on Twitter too much and talk to people. I get an opportunity to talk to wonderful people like Vivian every now and again.
Oh,
I'm lucky.
Who's this Vivian? Oh, hi Vivian. Who are you, Vivian?
So I am a recently graduated student from UBC, and I've been in the most, I guess, fundamental sense, I'm Chinese-Canadian, and I am moving on to doing my master's degree in Paris in Sciences Po, and I'm also a global shaper, which is a community of around, I would say, 8,000 or more people, young people below the age of 30, and we're arranged in different hubs all over the world, about under 400 of them, and we make a lot of locally impactful projects.
Wow, we are deeply envious.
Partly
Thank because
you.
You're young, but mainly because you are truly a global citizen in that sense. You were born in China. You've lived in Canada for how long?
Ooh, it's a bit of a complicated story.
Yeah, that's true. It is, isn't it? You've been back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Again, reflecting your perspective, I presume, that you are truly global.
In some ways, yeah.
Yeah, and you're going to Paris. And you don't know where you may end up?
Nope.
It's all possibility.
And you graduated from high school in Coquitlam.
Right? I did, yes.
Yeah. So you've got a pretty good grounding in this region. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say in some way, but I definitely also think because how transient the past 2 years have been in my life, that I'm getting a little bit disconnected. But then I believe we'll talk more about that.
Well, Peter, why did you ask Vivian to be your match to be the successor to your predecessor?
Well, a number of reasons. One is I was a mentor, just pure happen chance, to some program Vivian was in at UBC, and I really like talking to her because I learned so much from talking to her. And the journalist in me just wants to ask her questions. And I recognize that she represents a new Canadian, a Canadian with sort of roots in China and yet a lot of connection here and aspirations. She sees the world in a global way, which is, I tend to be fairly locally focused.
Oh my gosh, you are so rooted.
Yeah, and so I just thought this is a nice contrast and we could learn something.
When I say you're rooted, I mean there are places in this region, one in particular. Ladner.
Yes.
How far back do you go? What's the story there?
The town of Ladner is named after my great-grandfather and his brother who came out in the 1850s and settled there. They started in with the gold rush and then they came back down to the Delta and became farmers and then got in the fishing industry.
Classic settler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So you're the colonialist now.
Yeah. I had an interesting conversation with Ruth Adams, the elder from Tuason, the other day, and I was thinking, oh, man, your relatives and my relatives teed off here back in the day.
Where would your family have been in the 1850s?
Ooh, I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, just somewhere in China.
So? But where did you grow? Where did you grow up?
So I was born and raised in Beijing. My parents are... my dad's side of the family is from Beijing and the rural parts of it. And my mom is from the south of China in the province called Fujian. It's right across the street from Taiwan. So in a way, I'm also sort of like a north-south mix, baby.
So your parents were part of the urbanization of China.
Absolutely.
And you're an only child?
Yes.
Part of one child?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what was Beijing like when you were growing up? Do you have very strong impressions that you can share?
Yes. So when I was growing up in Beijing, there was, I would say, and still are, a very strong sense of community. And growing up in Beijing, I mean, there are no individual houses, and there's no individual houses in metropolitan cities in China. And in that environment, I would say it's pretty important to have those neighborhood moments when you have some kids that you can play with in the neighborhood and with friends in kindergarten and that kind of stuff. And my grandparents would take me to parks every morning and night sometimes after school, and we'll talk to the aunties and uncles and the other grandmas around and see what they're doing. So that's how it's been like growing up in Beijing. And my family also came from a pretty difficult spot because both my parents, they were psychologists. And back in the 90s and 80s, nobody cared about psychology in China because people had a hard time feeding themselves and getting good jobs. So how my family became pretty okay now is very much because of the urbanization and because of how much China has matured and still growing economically, that people started caring about, oh, wait a minute, we have the one-child policy, but, you know, children are so important, and what if something is abnormal about them psychologically? So,
what kind of environment would you like to live in? Let's assume that money really isn't a constraint on you. Would you choose, for instance, to live in a single-family house, backyard, front yard, apartment building?
I have not thought that much about it, but I think my preference would still be the apartment. I really enjoy those apartments with great facilities and stuff.
You want to be in an urban environment?
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter, you grew up in Ladner?
No, I grew up in Vancouver.
In what kind of environment?
Very much single family detached, upper middle class. I grew up in Shaughnessy for first 6 grades, and then I went away to private school in Vancouver Island. So.
And you live now?
I live now in Kitsilano in a single family detached home. I'm one of the very, very lucky people.
Would you prefer, I can't imagine, something else?
I could probably live in something else. My wife and I talk about this a little bit. But I am really fond of my garden, and we have just an unbelievably nice little spot there. And so on.
Yes, you do.
I'm happy there.
But you're a city councilor. You also served on regional boards. your job was to think about the future of Vancouver, can you, would you want to? Or do you feel you have to, we have to, make the single family house effectively obsolete?
Oh boy, that's a huge question that goes to the fact that, first of all, we have to accept that we've got 40,000 people coming to this region every year. If we take that as a given, then we've got to accommodate them somehow, and we can't go out, so we have to go up. And so I can see that is putting pressure on the single family home. I don't know that I would go as far as to say they're all going to be obsolete or we have
I'm
to draw.
I'm thinking more around the question of loss.
Will we have lost something when the single family homes are obsolete?
You can make gone? A case that this has been maybe the best place, without being cliched about it, putting it on a license plate, one of the best places on earth, and it's delivered a quality of life human beings have rarely and may never have.
Correct.
And was it not your job to facilitate the end of that?
I wouldn't say the end of it. I mean, you just have to take that and go from there. You've got to adapt. And I mean, I think of, look at the West End. It used to all be single family detached homes. And now it's not. And people don't say, gee, I wish we could go back to those single family homes. Those were the days. People adapt and they learn and they love what they've got now.
But they don't want to see a lot of people another West End anywhere
it's,
near
I'm there. Not saying it's an easy transition, but it's one that's coming and you have to deal with it.
Are you comfortable with that, or do you think there should be remain an aspiration, a possibility of the classic suburban environment? Don't they want that in China too?
Yes, and I think there is more of a reckoning with that kind of mentality as well. Because in China, what's been happening, especially in the city of Beijing, is there has been so many efforts and continued efforts of gentrification and also deporting people from other provinces, kind of like how a country deports other people, and forcibly removing these small businesses and small business owners. Of course, this targets only people from the working and lower classes. And there has been an effort to make Beijing beautiful again and try to tear down these old, very, very historic street quarters, which I have a lot of attachment to.
Hutong.
Exactly. And there has been that effort to kind of make everything pristine and sterile. And I hate that so much because a lot of the Hutongs with history, with culture, with what's uniquely special about Beijing, they're all lost in this process. And I do think there is a very fundamental attachment that people have of their identities to these places. And I think those things should be preserved.
Well, what about you? Do you want to live in a place where you can put down roots, gain an attachment, settle in, imagine living for the rest of your life?
Not that I can imagine that place right now, but I think I've already given a pretty good effort to do that in Canada, in Vancouver. So I'm pretty excited about what's going to come.
Wait a minute. You're just heading off to Paris.
Yes.
To do what?
I'll be doing a 2 years master's degree in Paris at Sciences Po on a master's in international security.
International security?
Yes.
Tell us more. What's that mean?
So international security covers everything from transnational crime to counterterrorism to cybersecurity to nuclear weapons treaties and protection. And it's a very broad field, one that I've been interested for a long time, and I want to pursue it more. So,
Vivian. So I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
Vivian, are you interested in this in any part because of your own life and your own feelings of concern about security of your family, if you speak out and do something here, or how things are going in China with the intense state security apparatus that's pushing down on people?
I mean, that's absolutely a part of it. And my interest in security, it's very much intertwined with human rights. And I find the narratives that's used to further security very interesting and how that hinges on human rights in terms of, you know, this whole discussion we have right now about Facebook, about digital democracy, about how tech tools are kind of taking away from democratic systems.
Surveillance capitalism.
Absolutely. So I find that whole discussion to be extremely fascinating, especially given my background. So this is why I want to learn more about it.
This is fascinating, isn't it? So you raised in China, you understand intimately, personally. And have you gained some of that perspective about this interest from being Canadian?
Disinterest in?
Global issues, global security.
So I think this thinking process happens with many immigrants. And it took me a long time. It took me until 2016, where I first got my summer job working in government, to really care about politics, to be honest. Because all the time before that, after I came here to finish high school at around 2012, I didn't really care about politics all that much. And I think that's also a symptom of people who came from societies where we don't have democratic systems. So there is the perception of come to Canada. It's like, okay, we made it. We don't have to make any other effort. But hold on. Wait, what's this new thing called voting? And, oh, we actually have some obligation to do this and to learn more about all these different parties. And there's a whole thing about it.
Well, what changed your interest? What gave you an interest in politics then? How did that change occur?
Right. So first, it was history. I've been very fascinated with history since high school, and that is due to some excellent and very dedicated high school teachers in Pine Tree Secondary, where I finished my high school. And it was in social studies class where, and I remember this correctly, just like so precisely in my mind because of how much impact it had on my mentality and my interest, is when they're talking about the Korean War. And how I understood that narrative to be completely different from what I was taught, even though I was not interested in it before when I was living in China, but still subconsciously that became my value system. And when we're talking about the Korean War in social studies, I was like, okay, this is not what I've been told at all. So after class, I confronted my teacher. I said, hey, what's this thing? What's containment of communism? What's this whole narrative? And he was really surprised about what I learned. So we had this like very nice exchange. And afterwards, I just felt like, you know, the world is exploding, like this huge light bulb in my head. I'm like, I have to find out more. There are other perspectives. Oh my God. So that kind of started my interest in history and politics later.
Oh, Peter, what about you? Have you always had an interest in politics?
I was raised in a sort of political family. My grandfather was a member of parliament in the 1920s for 10 years. So he had, you know, he was a fundraiser for John Diefenbaker, and Davy Fulton came over for drinks and dinner. And so I got kind of swept up in that a bit. And my grandfather always maintained the aura of a member of parliament. He didn't wait in lineups, and he was an important guy. He always thought of himself as more important than everybody else right to the end. So that sort of hung over me, and my immediate family wasn't so much involved, but I just, a bit like Vivian, I've just got a sort of a zany curiosity about what's going on and what ought to go on and why is this happening the way it is, and that drew me in.
So Vivian had this change because she's an immigrant. She had both stories, and the reconciliation of them has motivated your life now. You're rooted in this place. You never had anything else other than a sense of place.
Well, Gord, remember the 60s? I was at UBC in the 60s, and the lid came off for me then when we heard people talking about the Vietnam War and the American Empire and all these things in completely different ways than I had learned but taught before. And I had a very similar experience. Hey, there's a lot more going on. I'm going to have to find out a little more about other ways of looking at the world.
What world do you think we live in now, then, as far as being 70 years of British Columbians? Let me ask it more directly. In Vancouver, you're now the visible minority. 52% of the people of the city are, quote, people of color, predominantly Asian. Could you ever imagine that when you were growing up?
No, I never really thought much about it when I was growing up. And I settled into my happy neighborhoods and families and networks and so on, tennis clubs and all that kind of thing. I wasn't so much a big part of that, but that was just our world, and I can see that world is becoming less and less significant. And I mean, those were the days when you couldn't get into the Vancouver Club if you were a woman and all of that. And I think there's a lot of welcome change, and I think that the city's richer for it, for sure, culturally richer and probably economically richer. Well, definitely.
That's certainly what we tell ourselves. That's the Canadian dream mythology. But you were brought into it. What was your initial perspective when you looked around and saw who was in your classroom, who was in your neighborhood?
I mean, definitely diversity. I remember going into, again, secondary school. It's pretty interesting at just how many different types of people there are and how many different cliques there are, although I really hated cliques. But I would say the Canadian identity is absolutely important for me because, again, we talk about integration and assimilation and all these processes that immigrants have to go to. And I was thinking about this last night as well, about the first time I heard the word assimilation, and I didn't know I was actively trying to assimilate myself because I had seen how difficult my parents have tried. Given how welcoming and how open Canada is, it was still very, very difficult for them. So I made a mission to my 16-year-old self that, okay, I have to assimilate to Canadian society because this is how I will succeed. And that's been what I've been trying in middle school, you know, not listening to Asian music, not, you know, recognizing that part of me and trying to be as Western as possible, consume American movies, consume Canadian content, and really try to speak English as much as I can 24/7. And it's not until I talk to a classmate who is originally from Afghanistan, and I forgot what the conversation was, but then I brought up, oh, wouldn't it be hard to assimilate if we were like this? And she told me, I hate the word assimilation. And that was the first time I heard someone say that and give that opinion. And I thought, oh, why wouldn't someone want to succeed in Canada? Because I thought that was the only way. And then later I recognized that there are so many other models of integration, one being multiculturalism and pluralism and the Canadian mosaic, as people would say. And that's really been, you know, the time that I start to reconcile with, oh, wait, there's so many parts of my identity that I kind of threw away to be, in my perception, successful. So that's been what I've been trying to work on in the past few years. And I think I'm getting quite good at that. So
quite good at what?
Quite good at being just obscenely Chinese and Canadian at the same time.
Give us an example of what you would do or how that would manifest.
Ooh, yes. So absolutely, I would defend Vancouver to the extremes, especially in Europe and other countries. And I'm very proud of being Canadian. I always say that because coming to Canada and living in Vancouver has given me so much freedom to discover more parts of myself and to express them. And also just, I already say A a lot and sorry. Like, that's just obscenely Canadian. But I'm also obscenely Chinese at the same time because even in Germany, I was teaching my friends how to make dumplings from scratch and we spent like 3 hours on it, but it was worth it. So in both senses, I'm trying to be more comfortable with both my identities at the same time.
Do you think you may end up, though, in a situation where that allegiance will be required to one or the other?
I don't think so. I do think there might be pushbacks because, I mean, there's always that debate in immigrant societies and in immigrant groups, whether the immigrant group may be Chinese, Indian, any other, Greek, or even some other groups who think about, you know, immigrants who kind of integrated to another society as, oh, they're the other, they're the traitors, whatever. But I think that static, again, label is insinuating that there's not a lot of fluidity in terms of how people think and how people integrate. So on one side, I do think on the very general terms, maybe on the broadest scope of things, people might be quick to associate some people with these very harmful labels. But the other side of me thinks, you know, there's so much potential today, especially with young people, with having a more global identity and to understand things better, especially with the internet. So I also don't really think so in that case.
Is that the word we should use for the millennials? Fluid?
I'm going to let them decide what they want to be, how they want to be described.
This is our last chance to label. Come on, let's do it.
No, but I will say that the global thing, I think, is very important, because I think we've reached a stage in the problems of the world where they can only be solved globally. I mean, you're talking about international security. We're talking about space, satellites, climate change, all these things. We kind of have to get together as a global community to sort these things out. Or we can go back to our obscenely divided private tribal identities and fight it out to the end, which I sometimes fear a lot is where we're going to end up.
Both things are happening simultaneously
in our lives.
And you're jumping right into it. You want to be right at the, if not the center, there isn't a center, but you want to be immersed in this, I gather.
Absolutely. And I think part of it is definitely because of the high. The high of, again, kind of being exposed to all these different ideologies and all these different talking points and ideas. It's very exhilarating. And I think Peter can definitely attest to this, talking to so many different people and going to all these different meetings. It's a great feeling. And I do think, of course, there are issues with getting lost in this narrative. But a part of that is shaping one as a person first.
Well, what advice did you want to get from Peter with respect to navigating all those meetings, all those decisions, being a leader?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have questions for him?
Yes. So one thing I've been thinking about lately, and I've talked to a couple different people about this, is, again, running for office. Because so far my experiences have been very confined in public service, but not in the political side. And again, as a young person, and perhaps I'm really impatient, the change comes very slowly from that space. But I also have many friends who work in NGOs, in other sectors, who also tell me, you know, life is also pretty hard on that side, and making change is so difficult. And oftentimes when a critical juncture happens, changes happen. But, you know, it comes at very great costs and just very little reward and very slow progress. So I'm wondering, Peter, if you think that running for office and being in office is the way to push change quickly?
First, I'm always wary of the word change, because it can mean anything you want it to mean. And everybody has an agenda of change they think needs to happen, and they're going to push that, and they're often conflicting. I think running for office is one way of taking action on a whole spectrum of things. Building a strong neighborhood community is a form of taking action. And the retail politics of getting elected, yeah, you get to pull some levers, and nominally you're making the laws and the rules, but that doesn't happen without a whole lot of lobbying, a whole lot of political support for what you're doing, which has to be coming from somewhere lower down, and or in these cases, higher up from some mysterious internet sources. But there are lots of places where a person can apply pressure or assert themselves to make change. And I think you want to ask what you're best suited for. Because even behind every politician is a whole group of mastermind people, fundraisers and hustlers and people supporting them and people advising them and people giving them policy ideas. They're all part of the change equation.
You have to put together that team. You have to make the choices about who those supporters, those fundraisers, those hustlers are going to be. Will they give loyalty to you? You also have to understand that you're reliant on the institutional structure in which you're operating. And I would say have some confidence in that as a Canadian. The liberal democracy, the representative government, even the Queen. The stability with which our institutions have been able to allow for change to occur, immigration would be an outstanding example. What kind of society would make a decision or a series of decisions that would change the culture and color in a generation? And we did it. You're it. That's a pretty remarkable solidity, belief in the strength of our institutions to allow that. And it sounds like, this is my question, do you have confidence in that?
Is it
something that you can build on to allow for change while still relying on the foundations of those institutions?
I do think that's really important, and I do support it. And I think the foundation of the institutions are why Canada is able to make so much progress. I mean, in regards to immigration and many other things. And again, without these institutions, and as you mentioned, Peter, the support, there's no legitimacy in government. So the foundations have to remain strong for people to also support the government and for all of us to go in the correct directions. So I do have a lot of faith in Canadian institutions.
That's a pretty conservative position. Small c.
I'm reminded of a judge I knew who once said to me, he says, "What do you know what the ultimate source of law is?" I said, "I don't know. The Queen? No. The Senate? No. The Parliament? No. The Cabinet? No. The Supreme Court?" He says, "Not really." He says, "It's the will of the people." Because none of those institutions can do what they need to do without the will of the people behind them, to some degree.
Absolutely.
And somebody has to mobilize the will of the people, or express it, or educate it. And but I, to go back to running for office, I think that, and Gord, your point about trust in institutions, I really hope people will still, I think we're in great danger of eroding trust in political office and all these institutions, the media, the courts, everything. And there are people deliberately doing that so that whatever, they can take over in some way. But I think it's really important to keep at that and keep recognizing that running for office is one of the most dangerous, time-consuming, personally damaging, in some ways rewarding, for sure, things you can do. And I mean, I did it to a very small degree, and Gord was at my level for much longer time. But you look at the life people live and the abuse that they endure, and I think it's really important for people to keep believing that's important and keep getting up there and protecting the integrity of the system. When somebody tweeted the other day, I've had enough, I'm going to stop berating CEOs and union leaders and NGO people, but the only attacking politics is still a victimless crime. And I said, no, it is not a victimless crime. When you attack politicians and undermine trust in elected officers, you are undermining democracy and you are damaging people personally who you need to be out there.
Does your generation, I know, one of these big dumb questions, does your generation have confidence as Canadians?
I'm not sure. I think there's definitely divide between people of this generation. I do think there are people who don't have that sense of trust in the system and in all the institutions. And I would say, I mean, even though I believe in the system and I believe in democracy, doesn't mean it's perfect, and doesn't mean Canadian democracy and Canadian institutions are absolutely perfect. I do, of course, support the fundamentals of it and how, again, the will of the people and legitimacy in democracy, how that's important. But this generation is also very divided because you have people who are like me, who do want to go into government and who have this sense of projection of our careers and of our future in these institutions, to say, hey, that wouldn't exist if we don't believe in the institutions first.
So what do those who are discontent, what is the source of their discontent?
So for others, I think you can also see people of different spectrums. And I can definitely sympathize with some people in both of these spectrums. So the other one part of the spectrum is people who think, you know, again, sometimes in the right-leaning part of politics, thinking, hey, our institutions, we're getting too, you know, too pluralistic, we're getting too democratic, or, you know, some people's voices matter more than other people's voices. So in a way, then Canadian institutions have to withhold this power structure, right? And that leads some people to distrust institutions. And I would say the other extreme spectrum of it, maybe not too extreme now, and I do support that in some degree as well, is people who see the government and see how much is not getting in terms of, again, getting the will of the people, that it's not going deep enough in the nooks and crannies of society in consultations or whatsoever, or it's not communicating with people well enough in terms of getting their will. And activists and people in this space think, hey, you should do better. And because of this, maybe we need a new system. So there are these two larger groups. I'm sure there's some people in the middle as well, or in some more extreme ideologies.
Failure to consult.
But I want to ask, if people of your generation are not trusting the venerable institutions that got us this far, what are they trusting? Who are they trusting?
Populists, internet trolls,
people with loud voices in the internet mm-hmm. world, social media world.
But how I come to think of it is, I am definitely also very fiercely critical of our institutions and liberal democracy, and again with the same reasons as the people I've mentioned. You know, it's not representative enough. It does not get people's voices well enough, and therefore people's wills are not being upheld. But
think that's true, Peter? Failure to consult, not hearing, not responding, not representing?
Well, I have a hunch where you're coming from with this, Gord, where failure to consult often means that it's not going my way. I mean, they consulted with me, but they didn't do what I said, so therefore they must not have consulted properly. And that's a flaw. That's not a reasonable argument. I mean, it's an understandable one, but it's not a defensible one. And failure, I don't know. You'd think with all the polling ability and the surveying and the canvassing of people that we can do now, we could get a pretty good sense of what people want and do that. But then, of course, we're dealing with the misinformation that they're being fed that leads to those desires. So maybe you don't want to consult somebody who's just listening to some rabid nut bar on Twitter all the time to get their ideas.
So, Vivian, you've become a diplomat. You're at the UN. You have decisions, or at least recommendations, to make at this most senior level. And you realize the threat that you see and understand is not the one that's shared generally by the populations that believe they should be represented. Let's take climate change. What would you do?
So when I'm at a senior level and...
You realize there's a threat, an existential one, but the general public, whatever that is, doesn't share that concern or understanding. What do you do?
So the main part of it is, of course, communications, but communications goes many different ways. And this is also my critique about consultations is not only... It is a fault of consultations that people think, okay, it's not going my way, therefore I'm not being consulted properly. But there's also the huge area of consultations and why it's failing is how, you know, and I spoke to Andrea Raymer about this yesterday, actually, and she mentioned something very interesting is how we think consultations are, okay, we'll hold it at this hotel at this time. If you come, we consult you. If you don't come, okay, it's passed. But that is just not enough because you have to find different languages for different people to be able to understand an issue and for them to have the language to express their opinion. Because how do you communicate to the same people, you know, of the same city or community or nation about this one issue if people are also so diverse? So for me, someone like me who's, you know, voting is a new thing for me, although I've been a citizen for a while, but it's still something that I think deeply about, and I have to kind of tell myself every time, okay, you know, this is important and I want to do this, versus someone who's like Peter and who's have these civic duties and who have understanding about institutions for way longer. So our languages are very different. And our area of activities are also different. I don't go to the same bars or the same community centers as Peter does. And thus, if consultations and if communications are only accessible to someone like Peter, then I won't really get the opportunity to express my will or understand what the issues
are
anyway.
I'm just stunned to hear that you would say that in the age of Twitter and social media and Facebook. There is no end. We're inundated by people expressing their opinions. We're overwhelmed by it. And,
but,
the ability to use those tools as propaganda, as a way of intervening. I'm going back. If you're a decision maker and you're drowning in opinion, how do you choose a course of action?
So again, the opinion, I think, has to come from a very data-driven place. It has to come from very rigorous research with good data sets. And again, those are built on good consultations. So with that concrete information, then it's better for policymakers to make decisions.
You, Peter, have lived in the real world where climate change is an issue that's been of your concern for decades now. Is that true? Just more data and presumably consultation will be sufficient. Has it been?
No, it's not sufficient. No, there's too much emotion and self-interest and tribal cultures and so on wrapped up in the interpretation of the data that it's got to be, to change people's opinion, it's a big process. And sometimes it's externally driven. There's a crisis or catastrophe or a storm or flood or something that does it.
Vivian was saying, if I heard you right, that basically if you consult properly and hear clearly the opinion, that should be sufficient. That gives you the basis for action. Are you saying that's not true?
Well, in the real world of politics, that's the world you live in. You can't get too far away from what most people want, or you don't survive. But your question about if true leadership is to do X, but the people want Y, what are you going to do?
In the face of an existential threat.
You maybe have to be, I go back to the days of the very first NDP government in BC in the early 70s, when I was actually working in Victoria in the government there as a minor functionary. And Dave Barrett said, the premier at the time, said, we're going to be here for a short time. We're going to get a bunch of stuff done. We don't care if we get reelected. We're just going to go for broke. And maybe that's...
That proved to be accurate.
Correct. And they got a lot of stuff done that they wouldn't have done. They probably wouldn't have brought in the Agricultural Land Reserve and all ICBC, whatever, if they had been thinking, okay, after the next election, how's this going to sell? So I think you have to adopt, right now, we've got 12 years, or is it down to 11 years or something, to make all these key decisions.
You wouldn't be that kind of leader.
I think that depends on the subject. Of course, in climate change, when you're talking about people who completely disagree with the government when the government is trying to make these changes that will help us reduce our carbon footprint or all these things, I do think in that regard, then yes, you do need to do the right thing. And government should
have
discretion.
You said you would be data-driven. You would want to base your decisions on truth. The truth tells you there's an existential threat that the public is not prepared for and doesn't want change on the scale that you believe is necessary. And you believe, having consulted with them, that you would respect that. Am I right?
I think not necessarily, because it should be a combination of both, that the consultancy of the will of the people and the data-driven research should both go hand in hand. And, you know, if, again, in this context, right, for climate change, if the will of the people is on this one side and research is showing that, hey, we're facing an existential crisis, then you're going to have to deal with this huge thing that potentially can end humanity. And then we might have to just communicate with people better about, okay, this is a bigger problem that it might take you more steps to understand.
She's trying to parse it.
Well, no, I think this is getting to the crux of where we're stuck today is coming up with an acceptable narrative that leads to a decision. And we have warring narratives that are talking right across each other. and they're amplified into their own echo chambers. And it absolutely astounds me to get to a local example here. When we talk about the carbon tax and when people, the sort of Alberta meme of, we've got to get the oil and gas industry going, they'll have that entire discussion without ever saying the words climate change. And the climate change people will have the entire discussion without ever saying anything about the poor Alberta economy, which is a real thing. And the challenge that we face is somehow finding the intersection and getting in there and moving.
But give her advice on how to do that. She's going to be, she already is there. She's going to be living in the world of decision-making, or at least politics, policy, where she's going to see more than ever those conversations fragment.
You have to pick your place. I mean, there are certain people who are able, in a position, I think about Elizabeth May, she'll never get elected. She never has to worry about appeasing different groups of, but she just has to come up with, she can speak truth to power, the leader of the Green Party in Canada. And she can have a very clear and message. Certain activists can do that. And that's their role. And that's their push and their job to help the politicians come close to that, but not go to a place where they'll get completely pummeled or maybe physically endangered by angry people.
So long as Elizabeth May doesn't aspire to real power, to be able to make the decisions, she can critique from the outside. So long as Vivian wants to base her decisions on truth, but still consult, she doesn't have to make the trade-offs, the real tough trade-offs going to piss off a lot of people. May not even be possible under the current circumstance. Neither of you seem to have given a direction for how we're going to face these existential threats that are coming down on us.
No, I wish I had an answer, Gord. I mean, I'm chirping from the sidelines and saying, let's look at science, let's look at the data, and the data is screaming at us that we have to do something really big right now. And
you want to consult more.
So I think in policymaking, you definitely need that consultation process. But with, all these years of data building and how it's screaming at us, there has to be real action done. And a part of what people have been doing is to trying to kind of economize the problem of climate change so they can speak to people of those places where, talking right across each other about how we want to boost our economy with the oil and gas industry. And I think talking about it in that narrative is more attractive to people who are just completely on the other side of the spectrum. Because if their narrative is economic, then this narrative also has to be economic.
Well, then what about this solution? I'm voting for a tribal leader who is going to represent my interests over any others so they can get something done.
Well, there's where you need this narrative that will cross the boundaries.
I'm going to give you the narrative. I'm going to define you and say I will represent you.
Okay, but I think there are some positive narratives that can win over different groups. If we were just to talk about the transformation of economy to a renewable economy and all the opportunity, now we've got some area where we've got economic opportunity and we've got some green initiatives coming together. And that's the kind of challenge today's politicians, I think, face, to find that binding narrative that addresses the different sides. And we have to believe that it's out there somewhere. Otherwise, we're stuck with just, I'm going to push my pedal and you're going to push your pedal and we'll see who crosses the finish line first. That's where we're headed now, but
a Canada couldn't survive if we all went to our own tribal leaders without any willingness to
for
mutual
sure.
accommodation. But are you the kind of person who can craft those narratives, deliver them, sell them? Do you want to be?
Possibly. Definitely need more training, which is why I'm pursuing further education. And I think to an extent, we're already doing it. We're in this room right now. We're talking about climate change. We're talking about greening strategies, about how we can bridge this divide or just talk to other people better. So it's a start.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are in an emergency, and yes. When the place is burning, you can't have a long discussion about the best fire extinguisher. You got to just grab one and shoot.
Absolutely.
Peter, do you think someone who looks, sounds, comes from the background of Vivian can be one of our collective leaders?
Before I answer that question, I'm just going to blow off people who say, wow, I'm so, you know, if there's any hope in this world, it's the younger generation. They're so smart and they're so into it and they're going to do stuff. I think that's just such a cop-out, because so they are, and great, good for them. But that doesn't mean we just take this big heap of dung and throw it at them and say, they're so smart, they'll figure it out. But now that we've done that and now that we're doing that,
yeah.
I think Vivian's pretty diplomatic. I think she's very measured, and that is a very important role, because if people are screaming, you know, you think of your classic bargaining, union bargaining thing, there's always these magic mediators who can somehow come in and listen to both sides and calm everything down and come to a solution. And boy, do we need those people. So there's a role for diplomatic people, but there's a role for the barricades people too.
I think you're right about Vivian. We're going to talk to you in a third person.
Okay.
I was struck on our initial conversation that she had defined herself as a diplomat.
Yeah.
And was actually pursuing it in a very orderly way. I'm going to be here. I'm going to do that. I don't think I can recall meeting someone quite like that.
Well, I'm going to maybe get a little too personal here, but I suspect that part of that approach comes from the fact that you've got parents who are psychologists, so you're kind of tuned into this. But also, back to the security thing, you got to be careful what you say. Because if you said the wrong thing too much, too loudly in the wrong places, could it impact your parents if you're not being diplomatic?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I do know a thing or two about self-censorship, so that's also a part of the equation.
Have we labeled you correctly?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know about this diplomatic career yet, but we shall see, I guess.
Well, it's interesting that you're also interested in security, because the security forces in China are setting a new standard for surveillance and repression. And you're somewhat caught up in that just by having relatives in China. And so I think it's interesting to me that you're looking at that area, because I'm guessing you're trying to figure out, you know, how do you keep, one of the areas would be, how do you keep that under control so that there isn't just some sort of new digitally driven repression that the likes of which we've never seen before? And at the same time, how do we speak out and respect each other and engage in open debate?
Right. So that area is super interesting to me, again, because I never really thought about it when I was growing up, because there's just so much surveillance going on, and you're always told to, okay, you walk around like people are watching you at all times. So that's how you grow up. That's how you go to school. That's how you play in the playground. That's how you just go about life.
And does that mean you don't talk about certain things? You don't say certain things?
Mm-hmm. And coming to Canada and there's no cameras at some places where I feel like there should be cameras. So, and then Edward Snowden happened, talking about digital privacy and the right to your own data. That was like kind of mind-blowing, because I thought, hey, why are people getting hung up about this? You know, we're always getting watched anyways. And I realized, hey, wait a minute, that's not the same. But maybe I think we're getting closer and closer to having the same realities, because as we know, in these giant corporations, including Facebook and Google, they know our information better than we do, and they can predict what we want before we even thought about it.
Or what's even worse, not even they, some algorithm, some artificial intelligence entity of some kind is the only thing big enough to gather and sort all this data and is now taking an active role in determining what we see and think and do.
For sure. And this is, of course, a new policy area. And there has not been too much regulation regarding this, although it's been a very hot topic in recent years for good reason, which is why I personally became very interested in it. Of course, having the background also shapes my perspective, but it's going to be a world that especially my generation and the further generation are going to have to come to, again, reckoning with.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like for you to hear people speak out and just say things that you thought, oh, how could they say that? Do they realize that they're going to get in trouble for that? Or have you become a little more open about what you say? Or do you still have that early guardedness that you learned in China?
So I think the best way I can kind of comparatively explain this phenomenon is kind of in combination to how people will talk about coming out as a person of LGBTI background. And I don't think it diminishes people's credibility when they want to select the people that they come out to and select the communities that they want to feel safe and they feel safe as a part of, versus those people who just write a Facebook post or call everyone or go to their family one day and say, hey, I'm gay or I'm bisexual, I'm lesbian. I think those both of those ways are valid in terms of expressing your opinion and expressing your identity. So for me, yes, sometimes I feel like, oh my God, this is a bad look and could impact your family. But for those people and most people who speak out and most people who speak out that we know or are getting media attention, I believe their discretion. And because of that, I support them equally as I would support someone who did not speak up, because I respect their opinion. I respect how they want to convey it.
Respect is so key here. And the great achievement of liberal democracy in our time, I think, is that, the circles of respect have increased and broadened. Speaking as a LGBTQ, I would not have imagined that I would have been able to get married. I realize the institutions, the courts, parliament, community, made that life possible. So I'm often surprised by people in the LGBT community who don't have respect for those institutions. I'm really struck by the fact that you have been able to live in both these worlds and have assimilated the values of them in such a way that you now have a coherent outlook. What would you want for the next generation, the one you already see coming up, the one behind you? Do you see difference there?
Yes, I do. So, of course, the first difference that came to mind is nobody uses Facebook anymore. The younger generation, speaking as a millennial, I guess. So the generation, I guess the post 9/11 generation, many people don't have Facebook. They think is like a grandpa thing now. I'm on it all the time, so I don't know. But, you know, people use Instagram. I think youth of today are more prone to, again, those very fast food type of communication in terms of video, images, but that's also nothing new. Since the birth of television and that kind of stuff, it's been the trend.
Do they seem even more fluid than you?
Perhaps. I also, again, going to the intergenerational dialogue, I don't have many friends who are younger than me, so that is a problem. I do need to talk to more people like that. But I do think young people now are more in tone with the different political narratives because they have such a grasp of digital tools, of internet, and of those, whether it's memes or just internet culture, pop culture, that they get that in input a lot more, even more than us. So there is great opportunity as well as great risk. Again, when you say, when we talk about great risk, for example, like incel culture, like how right-wing, again, demagogues and these personalities can infiltrate communities of young people online and get away with it or create huge influence. But then we have great opportunity with young people like Greta Thunberg and many other youth activists, for example, the activists of the Parkland shootings, who can get their amplification loudly and clearly. And because they're even a younger generation, they face even more risks than us in terms of climate change and all these big problems. So again, it's just my judgment, and I definitely need some more friends in the younger generation as well.
Hey, 70-year-old. What do you think? Got confidence?
Confidence in the younger generation?
Yeah, this one in particular.
Do I have confidence in Vivian?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a lot of confidence in Vivian.
No, but what she represents.
What she represents? I think she's coming into this awkward, complex, unclear world that we all inhabit, and learn as we learn more about it, we just know that it's not black and white and all that kind of thing. And I think she really gets that. My worry about the younger generation is how their brains are being addled and their emotional development is being crippled and distorted and damaged by their exposure to screens, which, as my son says, who's keeps his grandchildren off screens as much as he can. He says, when I see a little kid in a screen, it's like the parent has given that kid a cigarette. You know, it's that much harm. And it's permanent brain wiring damage. And between that and the impending arrival of artificial intelligence at a scale and level of capacity and knowledge that we can't even imagine, I think we're coming into quite a different world where the usual institutions of control are not going to be in control anymore.
Thank you for that topic for one of our next podcasts. We're going to pursue that. I'm struck, though, by, I'm going to say the success, I won't put much of a qualifier on it, of the great experiment that Canada started, let's say 1967, our centennial, the best year of our lives for this country. And we undertook to change our immigration strategies. We moved away from England and UK and Northern Europe and changed our society by the policies and the people that we brought in. Hi, Vivian. You're one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worked out real well. I think you've just got that combination that I can see from China, from your experience here. You've blended them. I don't think you're going to be a leader in the sense of a Greta or someone who's going to be articulating a vision. You are going to be the person who shapes the visions of the policymakers. And I actually think that's just as important a role as the policymaker themselves. So on behalf of all the other 70-year-olds, we wish you well.
Go at it, Vivian. Make it work.
Thank you.
Make the world
I'll do my
safe
best
for my grandchildren.
Thanks, Peter. It's been a great doing exactly what I hope for.
Good. Thanks,
a little
Gord.
Bit of torch
Thanks,
passing Vivian. Here, a little bit of perspective. Great conversation. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.